Our second case this morning is United States against Crudup. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Captain Jeremy Stevens, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Mark Teletoci. We represent the appellate in time, Private Demetrius Crudup. Once a court determines evidence has been admitted in violation of the Sixth Amendment, the government must demonstrate that there is no reasonable possibility that that evidence contributed to the findings. In this case, for appellate's conviction, specification 4, charge 1 to be upheld, the government must show beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not a fact of achieving that conviction. That is a standard the government cannot meet. The test is set forth by the Supreme Court and used by this court, beginning with Vandeweer and through Hall and Othero, calls for review of several factors which the Army Court failed to examine. As discussed in Hall, this is not a test of legal sufficiency. Rather, it's a question of whether or not the government can show, beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidence played. There's no reasonable possibility it played a role in the conviction. In this case, despite defense counsel's objection, the military judge allowed a law enforcement officer to recount out-of-court statements made by the appellate court concerning the appellate's alleged assault of their infant son. The gist of those statements, Your Honor, were that she was pushed to the ground while she was holding the baby by appellant, and that the baby had a kick to the face. Examining the Van Arsdale factors, first in terms of the importance that evidence played in the conviction of the appellant. As in Hall, the evidence was central to the government's case, and its admission was not harmless. The trial counsel found the evidence extremely important and used it as, not just in his argument, excuse me, but as a rebuttal, his final words to the fact finder. When he states, and this is at the Joint Appendix at page 54, Sergeant Vasquez testified that when he arrived on the scene, he spoke with PC. PC said, "He hit my baby." In an effort to emphasize the value of such essential testimony, the trial counsel then argued that the wife's statement was reliable because it happened immediately after the incident, and she had no reason to lie. The trial counsel also referred to Sergeant Vasquez's recitation of the testimony as, in fact, the wife's statement. The trial counsel also comments on why excited utterances in general are favored by the court, claiming they are more reliable because declarants are likely to tell the truth in such circumstances. The military judge overruled the objection, finding that in these circumstances, the circumstances surrounding the statements created the reliability. As in Hall from this court, in Morgan, a circuit court case, the source of the evidence is also important. Here, these are the wife's statements, admitted not just through the other witness, but through a law enforcement officer. This, as talked about in Hall, decimates the defense. Clearly, the government cannot show there's no reasonable possibility the fact finder did not consider those statements, especially when the trial counsel alludes to them so strongly during his final words to the fact finder. Secondly, Your Honor, we also look at the lack of the cumulative nature of these statements. The wife is like no other witness. Her testimony is unlike any other evidence the prior fact received, and is arguably the most important piece of evidence presented. Here, no other witness testified. I was holding the baby. They all testify as what they observed at night from a distance away. It is clearly a reasonable possibility that the erroneously admitted evidence played a role in appellant's conviction, especially given the testimony of Mrs. Rogers and the vacillation specialist Finelli. In fact, a closer look at the witnesses who did testify at trial, only one other witness testifies that she saw the shove, which is at the heart of the specification. Moving next to the contradictions at trial among the witnesses, the harmful effect of the evidence is apparent when considered alongside the evidence. The government's own witness, Mrs. Tangela Rogers, observed the alleged incident between appellant and his wife that night. In court, she testified that the victim fell of her own accord, and that Mrs. Rogers herself picked up the child before any physical contact with appellant and his wife.
What are we to make of the fact that Mrs. Rogers' statement is contradicted by appellant's own sworn statement to law enforcement?
We look at her statement in regards to this specification, where she says the child was nowhere near, which is on all fours with the appellant's statement to police officers that he admits to pushing the wife, but the child was not there when he pushed the wife. Mrs. Finelli did not testify that she saw the push.
The, uh,
The CCA referred to the son's injuries as well as the wife's injuries in addressing this issue. Was there medical evidence of the son's injuries?
There was no medical evidence of the son's injuries. There was lay testimony about bruises that individual witnesses had observed that they did not observe previous to the incident. But this is a point about the evidence in the joint appendix. The pictures and also the medical records all relate to the wife and relate to a separate incident that is not at the heart of the one Sergeant Vasquez has testified about. Specialist Finelli is key. He doesn't say he saw a push or a shove, but rather by the time he got to the window, the appellant's wife was already on the ground holding the baby. In fact, what does he add? I mean, the heart of this assault charge is that the appellant shoved the wife while she was holding the child. The only corroboration that the child was in the appellant's wife's arm when the appellant pushed her was elicited from Sergeant Karen Larson. Although, as we've discussed, this is not a test of whether or not the government can meet a prima facie case or whether or not they could show legal sufficiency, but whether or not the testimony of the appellant's own wife, who stated, he shoved me while I was holding the baby, he kicked the baby, whether or not the fact finder considered that.
Why should we discount Sergeant Larson's testimony?
I'm not saying you have to discount it, but in the context of all the other Van Arsdale factors, it alone doesn't get us past the showing. It alone cannot help the government meet its burden that the evidence that the appellant's wife put out was not considered. It may be enough to corroborate what she said, and it may go somewhat to whether or not the government had a strong case, which we don't concede that they do on the specification, but it alone does not answer the question. The question here is not one of legal sufficiency and whether or not they can prove that case.
But the same facts are being testified to. It's your point that it's coming from the wife, so that makes it more important?
That's also what was talked about at Hall and Morgan. Yes, Ron. The source of the evidence is important. Here she's a familiar witness and also a victim. What she says is unlike any other evidence the trier of fact is going to present. If the situation were reversed, and if it were, for instance, Specialist or Mrs. Finelli testifying through the cop what they observed, and the wife, in fact, testified as a victim in court, then obviously what the wife says is going to be more important than what some other tangential witness said through the law enforcement officer.
But you would agree that the evidence is in before the members through other means, particularly through Sergeant Larson.
Sergeant Larson's testimony would prove a prima facie case of assault. However, that's not the end of the analysis under Van Arsdale, Hall, and Thurr.
Right. But, I mean, it does go to the importance of the witness's testimony and whether it was cumulative.
It goes into both those. However, I think when we look back at the way the military judge treated and is also the trial counsel, the government has to show this evidence was unimportant. Not that the evidence was outweighed, but that it was unimportant in relation to everything else that the fact finder received. And here they can't prove that when they themselves stand up during rebuttal and argue as to how much more reliable the statements were. And the judge herself states that the circumstances surrounding this evidence create this reliability. The next factor Van Arsdale tests is that the wife herself didn't testify. Thus, there is no other chance to utilize what the Supreme Court has called the greatest legal engine for discovering the truth. In Othero, out-of-court statements by family members were deemed harmless to a fraud conviction due in part to the irrefutable incrimination evidence provided at documentary evidence, and also because the appellant himself had been able to get a stipulation from the sister/wife refuting earlier statement. The evidence in Hall was not deemed harmless, however, as undercut innocent ingestion defense to a cocaine use specification. As in the case of Barr, the evidence in Hall pitted the accused against a familial witness's testimony without the opportunity for cross-examination. Appellant's case presents an even stronger argument than was seen in Van Arsdale, where the defendant's cross-examination on bias was merely restricted. Here, there was no opportunity to cross-examine a witness. An in-court examination of the wife would have yielded a clear opportunity to test her truthfulness that does not exist in the way the testimony was actually offered. If she had testified in court, the wife would have been subject to rigorous cross-examination on her felony convictions for lying and fraud.
But wasn't that information put in front of the members by cross-examination of other witnesses?
It was brought up to the judge through documentary evidence, yes, Your Honor, but we contend that that's not the same as cross-examining the declarant on the stand about that and having the fact finder be able to observe her reaction and observe her, how she explains away or not. And the piece of paper that was admitted, Your Honor, the record is just a one-line recitation of what the conviction was for. It is not getting into the facts and circumstances of what she did, Your Honor. If the wife had testified in court, the trier of fact would reveal to the judge not only her demeanor, as we discussed, but also her testimony in light of her clear record for untruthfulness. This right to cross-examine is fundamental to the Confrontation Clause. In Van Arsdale, it's important to know where this test first developed. The extent of cross-examination otherwise permitted was the problem here because the witness had been on the stand, the judge cut short the cross-examination, would not allow counsel to delve into certain areas regarding bias of the witness.
If she had been on the stand, what is it that you contend the defense counsel would have been able to elicit about her prior convictions from her while she was on the stand?
She would have been able to explain those convictions. She would have been cross-examined on those, i.e. such testimony as, are you lying now, basically, Your Honor? And you would also see not just the words she was saying, but the fact where the fact finder would be able to judge her reactions to those questions, her demeanor when she's answering these questions, and compare things side by side, as opposed to giving a piece of paper after she's already heard this testimony from Sergeant Vasquez.
But if she was asked, isn't it true that you were convicted of larceny, for example, and she said, yes, that's true, what else do you think could have been made of that fact?
The questions that will come out during that examination, such as, you were convicted of this, and how does that, and she goes through and continues her testimony, which we'll conceive might may or may not have been consistent with what she talked about to Sergeant Vasquez, is still greater than that piece of paper the judge got. The fact that even I can ask one question about these convictions is still going to be more than what's put on this piece of paper, which shows that you have the convictions.
Well, two witnesses were asked whether they were aware of those convictions, weren't they?
Yes, sir. Without the opportunity to cross, the fact finder cannot observe the demeanor and reactions of the declarant on the issue such as perception, her recollection, her bias, and here especially, her veracity. The Army Court's opinion in this case is similar to the reason used by the District Court in Lowry v. Collins, just set aside by the Fifth Circuit. There, that Circuit Court determined the lower court's cursory review a classic but irrelevant sufficiency of the evidence analysis. As in Lowry, the Army Court here shoehorned a short, circular statement on the weight of the government's evidence in between its proclamation on the harmlessness standard. As in Lowry, where the analysis was wrong and the lower court's decision was set aside, this court should follow suit. Here, the out-of-court statements were from the wife, a victim herself in this case, who testified that the appellant pushed her while she was holding the baby and that the baby was kicked. There is at least a reasonable possibility that the fact finder considered that evidence in convicting the appellant. The government has not shown beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no reasonable possibility the statements of the appellant's wife had no effect on the client. Because of that, the Army Court's decision should be reversed and the conviction should be set aside. This case remanded for safety.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Please, the court. I'm Captain James, NIA, along with Colonel Denise Lynn, represent the United States in this matter. The Army Court correctly held that any error in admitting Portia Crudup's statement was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. While the Army Court did not specifically reference the factors set forth by the United States Supreme Court in Delaware v. Van Arsdale, but used by this court in the United States v. Arthur, the review of the Van Arsdale factors as applied to the facts of this case demonstrate that the Army reached the correct conclusion that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The first factor in Van Arsdale test requires an analysis of the importance of the witness's testimony in a prosecution's case. And in this case, the statements made by MP Vasquez regarding Portia Crudup's statement were minimal, if any, importance to the government's case. In fact, the most important aspects of MP Vasquez's testimony involve what he saw, not what he heard. He saw the house in disarray where the incident began. He testified that the victim was in distress, that something physical had happened in the house.
The victim in this case is whom?
Mrs. Crudup, Portia Crudup.
Isn't the appellant arguing about the child, especially the fourth specification?
That is correct, Your Honor. It is our
How is the house being in disarray? How does that prove or disprove the fact that she was or was not holding the baby at the time of this event?
Well, Your Honor, what that shows is that if you take a logical view through the facts of what happened, it's circumstantial evidence that there was an altercation between the two. But you are correct, Your Honor. Jordan Crudup was also a victim. In this particular case, the victim, Mrs. Crudup, was holding the child at the time of the incident.
Isn't so, that the issue, whether she was holding him at
that
the
is,
time?
That is the only issue, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't believe anything else is being contested. The appellate himself confessed that he did kick and push her. So
push
that,
the wife?
The wife.
But not the child.
The question is whether or not the child was being held at the time.
Well, if that's the only question that we're here to decide or that is pivotal in this case, why is not the mother's testimony important on that? I mean, the first Van Arsdale issue is whether or not it's important to the government's case.
There are several factors in the Van Arsdale test.
Well, let's take the first one.
You're correct, Your Honor. And the court has to go through a series of weighing the different factors. But also the court has to determine whether or not that particular testimony was cumulative to other testimony.
Well, that's the second criteria. Let's go to the first criteria. I mean, why would not it be important to have the mother of the child testify that she was holding the child?
Your Honor, I think the analysis is whether or not M.P. Vasquez's testimony, recitation of what Portia Crudup said, whether that was important to the prosecution.
Well, in effect, the mother is testifying through the military policeman. And obviously that was a Crawford violation, and the CCA appropriately held that it was. And the question then is whether or not it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we go to Van Arsdale. The first Van Arsdale criteria is whether or not that testimony was important to the government's case.
Your Honor, I think it's a different question whether or not it was important or whether it was important to the government's case. In this particular case, it turns out not to be important to the government's case.
Why?
Because
Why?
Of other because of other testimony, okay. Your Honor, because of the confession, because of the eyewitness.
The confession states that the child wasn't there. So how does that support your argument?
That's simply circumstantial evidence that she was kicked, and from that point,
he clearly confesses repeatedly that beating up on his wife. But in the context of confessing to a lot of other stuff, the one thing he does not confess to is hitting his child.
That is correct, Your Honor. It's an analysis. It's logical steps that have to be followed to get to the point where the court can determine whether or not Jordan Crudup was in Portia Crudup's arms at the time of the assault. But that is part of it. It does not prove it, but it goes to proving it.
Counsel, you started out, I think, by saying that it was what Sergeant Vasquez saw rather than what he repeated that was important. What is it that he saw that goes to whether or not the appellant assaulted his child? And if that's not what you said, then I apologize.
That is what I said. That is, again, it's just a logical step in the process to get the court comfortable to the point where only has to determine whether or not the child was in Portia Crudup's arm.
Okay, but what you said, Sergeant Vasquez, what did Sergeant Vasquez see as opposed to what did he hear?
Sergeant Vasquez entered the appellant's home, saw that the house was in disarray. He testified that Portia Crudup was in distress. He testified that something physical had happened at the house, and he testified that he saw bruises and swelling on her face.
Did he give any testimony about what he saw with respect to the child?
He did not.
Thank you.
Continuing with the first factor, the government would also like to point out the appellant brings a case of Madrigal versus Bagley, which was a recent case. In that particular case, there was, as opposed to in this case, where there was just two sentences, basically, the recitation of Portia Crudup's statements. In that case, the government relied on 79 pages of testimony and mentioned it at least 20 times in its closing argument. And we also distinguish U.S. v. Alvarado, in which case the court said, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the prosecution insistently relied on the statement. Here, again, there was only two statements, one statement, two sentences, and relied on twice in the closing arguments. Now, I move to the second and third factors. They somewhat overlap, and it can be addressed together. And it is whether or not the testimony was cumulative and whether or not there was the presence or absence of contradicting evidence. The government presented overwhelming corroborating evidence of Portia's statement. Again, there was a confession. He pushed her and kicked her. There was
Hang on. How does the confession that I kicked my wife corroborate the fact that the wife was holding the baby?
Again, Your Honor, the confession is just an important circumstantial evidence in getting to the point where all the court has to determine whether or not the baby was in Portia Carter's arm, and which is where you get to Sergeant Larson. Sergeant Larson saw the appellant hit Porsche while Porsche held the infant. Appellant kicked his wife, saw the bruising and swelling on both Porsche Carter and the baby's face after the incident, which were not there prior to the incident, and saw the appellant hit the infant as he hit or shoved his wife. In addition to testimony from Sergeant Larson, there was testimony from Specialist Finelli. Specialist Finelli saw the appellant kick Porsche while Porsche held the infant and saw Porsche's injuries before and after the incident. There was also testimony from Mrs. Finelli. She is Sergeant Specialist Finelli's wife. She initially called the police, and she saw Portia Carter banged up, bruises on her arms, and she also saw bruises on the baby's face. In light of this overwhelming corroborating evidence, the statements were cumulative.
I'd like to ask you about factor number four with respect to the extent of cross-examination. Is there any evidence in the record that if Mrs. Crudup had been cross-examined, that she would have recanted the statement that she allegedly gave to Sergeant Vasquez, the Sixth Amendment violation? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, ma'am, I do. Yes, Your Honor, I understand what you're asking. There's no evidence to that in the record. But while on factor four, I'd like to point something out from the government's point of view. The Confrontation Clause cases basically come in three broad categories. There's the admission of out-of-court statements, as here in Crudup. There's the cases where there's some kind of restriction imposed by law or the trial court on the scope of cross-examination, which was Van Arsdale. And then there are the cases of what I call faulty memory, cases where there is some kind of cross-examination where the declarant claims he can't remember. The extent of the cross-examination, that factor is sort of a round peg that you're trying to fit into a square hole in this particular case, simply because there was no cross-examination. There was no cross-examination at all. I'm saying that that's sort of an imperfect factor to fit in. However, I'm not saying that the court has to ignore it.
Can we consider the fact that with respect to the things that appellant's counsel is saying she could have been cross-examined about, that information was in front of the trier of fact?
Yes, Your Honor. This court can assume the full damaging effects of some cross-examination of her. And still, it's overwhelming and cumulative, and it's still cumulative to the other evidence in the case.
Is it cumulative as to quality?
Can you repeat that, Your Honor?
Is it cumulative as to quality? You have two neutral witnesses who say the baby was there and they saw it happen. You have one witness who says it didn't happen, and then you have the wife who says it happened. But the wife's testimony is qualitatively different, is it not, than the neutral witnesses? She's a victim. It's her child. The judge has already found her to be reliable, at least for the purposes of admitting her out-of-court statements as hearsay. So is that not qualitatively different? It may actually be qualitatively different one way or the other way, but it's different.
It is different, Your Honor. There's no such guidance in Van Arsdale or any other courts of how exactly a court is to weigh particular evidence. I will point out, though, as you have stated, The two witnesses, who Sergeant Larson and Specialist Finelli, were both unbiased witnesses.
And so we should not, when we're assessing cumulosity, we should only assess whether the same thing was said twice rather than who said it and how. Quality is not part of that equation.
I don't know if that's the government's position. I think quality is important. It is something that the court should consider. And I move to the fifth factor, the overall strength of the government prosecution's case. It was overwhelming, Your Honor. And again, the basis of that testimony, the best basis of the government's case was Sergeant Lawson's unbiased testimony, Specialist Finelli's testimony. There was a witness referred to by the appellant, Mrs. Rogers, and Mrs. Rogers' testimony was clearly biased. If there are no more questions, may I briefly conclude? A review of the Van Arsdale factor shows that the Army Corps correctly held that the erroneous admission of Portia Credit's statements to MP Vasquez was harmless beyond reasonable doubt. Accordingly, this honorable court should affirm the finding of innocence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Briefly, I think I'll just real briefly on something Judge Baker brought out, the difference between cumulativeness, cumulosity, and corroboration. While other witnesses may corroborate the underlying facts of what the appellant's wife said, that goes to one factor, i.e. the presence or absence of contradicting corroborating factors. The idea of cumulativeness is a separate factor under Van Arsdale. In this case, no other witness got on the stand and was able to say, he hit my baby, he pushed me while I held the baby. The wife or family member did not anywhere else testify in the record. So there is a qualitative difference here in terms of the evidence presented. What this case comes down to, though, is there is a tie, or at best a contradicting and conflicting story presented by the witnesses. Appellant's wife's statements broke that tie. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. Thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is submitted, and this is our last argument for the week. The clerk will adjourn the court.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.